You are now listening to Chess is Lit on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Musqueam people at the University of British Columbia. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Chess is Lit. We are back with another episode of the Shakespeare Sonnets series. We'll kind of get through things as much as we can. We'll start off with Sonnet 60. But before that, I just have one song to play for you guys, and some ads, show promos, and PSAs, and so we'll be right back after this. Oh, and the first song is called Jessica and Angel by Vern Chichu, so we'll be back after this.
Every time I close my eyes, I can see your pain. And I know I need to open my eyes so I can see the beauty around me. Letting go of the past, so hard to do when you feel pain. But you know you can't erase love from your heart, dirty stain. Jessica.
Jessica, an angel when she went away. Everything that has bound this couple is now unraveling before us. This April 17th and 18th at 7 p.m. at Left of Main, James Kudelka's Half an Hour of Our Time is a duet that is dense with incident, performed entirely in silence. James Kudelka's Half an Hour of Our Time was originally commissioned by Moon Horse Dance Theater in 2008 and performed by Claudia Moore and Dan Wilde. This 30-minute duet was primarily influenced by Jean Cocteau and Francis Poulenc's one-act opera, La Voix Humaine. Among today's most versatile and innovative dance artists, Kudelka has choreographed for leading ballet companies and smaller contemporary troupes. This presentation is a rare opportunity to witness his work in an intimate setting. Visit plasticorchidfactory.ca for more information.
If you enjoy bluegrass and old-time music, please join up and become a member of the Bluegrass Music Association of Canada, the BMAC. With your membership, you'll receive a quarterly full-color Bluegrass Canada magazine, as well as have access to the Bluegrass Canada website. Your membership will also allow you to contribute to the nomination process of the Canadian Bluegrass Music Hall of Fame. Help BMAC promote bluegrass artists with up-to-date information, including band members, performance locations, and helpful advice for bands wishing to travel to the USA. And finally, it will allow you to access information for festivals and events across Canada, bluegrass radio listings, organization partnerships, and a resource library for all things bluegrass. To learn more, log on to bluegrasscanada.org or call Mike Higgins at membership at 905-567-4708.
Welcome to Lethal Refresh.
I'm Danny.
I'm B.
I'm Stuff.
I'm Jay.
Let's get lethal. Let's get refreshed.
When it's darkest, we always attract the brightest people. Baby, you a light. Shift my whole world to the right.
Please listen to Lethal Refresh on CITR 101.9 FM. I'm Nardor the Human Serviette and Doo-Doo-Loo-Doo.
Doo-Doo! Thank you!
Lethal Refresh, every Monday, 12 to 1 p.m. New music every week.
Re-20-20. Catch up, yeah, check that one. I get eat, son. And then my little tie. Yeah.
Did you?
We are back. That was Jessica and Angel by Vern Chichu and some ads and some show promos and PSAs. We will start off with Sonnet 60 today. And so, let's give this one a read. Like as the waves make toward the pebbled shore, so do our minutes hasten to our end, each changing place with that which goes before, in sweet toil all forwards do contend. Nativity, once in the mane of light, crawls to maturity, wherewith, being crowned, cooked ellipses against his glory fight, and time that gave doth now his gift confound. Time doth transfix the flourish set on youth, and delves the parallels in beauty's brow, feeds on the rarities of nature's truth, and nothing stands but for his scenth to mow. And yet his times and hopes by verse shall stand, praising thy worth despite his cruel hand. So here the poet meditates on life's inevitability and inevitable course through maturity to death. And everything he says is a victim of time's scythe. And so once his poetry will stand against time, which will, as a consequence, keep him alive, or keep alive his praise of the beloved. And so lines 1-4, we get the metaphor of waves and time. And not a metaphor, a simile. And so a simile comparing the time to ocean waves, just as waves steadily and inevitably move toward the shore, so too do movements in our lives move towards their conclusion, which is death. And the lines each changing place with that which goes before, and sequent toil all to forward do contend. These lines emphasize the continuous and laborious nature of time, and how each minute follows and replaces the previous one in an unending orderly struggle. And there's also a sense of exhaustion in this phrase, toil, which reinforces the inevitability of time's progression. Moving on to lines 5-8, the word nativity refers to birth here, emerging in the phrase mane of light, suggesting both daylight and perhaps divine illumination. However, yet these noble beginning, like this noble beginning, leads only to a slow progress, which is seen in the phrase crawls towards adulthood, which is a temporary triumph. As soon as maturity is reached, decline will begin, and this is seen in the phrase crooked eclipses, where it represents forces, perhaps fate, misfortune, or aging, that diminish one's glory. And so time, once the giver of life and growth, ultimately becomes a destroyer. And so through this, we could see a bit of an irony here in time's confounding, how time confounds its own gifts. Moving on to lines 9-12, here, youth's vitality in the phrase flourish is pierced or pinned by time, the parallels dug into the brow, refers to wrinkles, which could also infer visual or visible signs of aging. Time also seems to consume what is rare and beautiful in nature, so no one or nothing can escape the or his destructive path. Now the final couplet here, it kind of shifts the tone from despair to defiance, and the speaker asserts that poetry can endure even as everything else fades, and his verse will preserve the beloved's worth and beauty against time's cruel hand. That was Sonnet 60. We'll move on to Sonnet 61. Is it thy will thy image should keep on open my heavy eyelids to the weary night? Dost thou desire my slumbers should be broken while shadows like to thee do mock my sight? Is it thy spirit that thou sendest from thee so far from home into my deeds to pry, to find out shames and idle hours in me, the scope and tenor of thy jealousy? Oh no, thy love, though much, is not so great. It is my love that keeps mine eye awake, mine own true love that doth my rest defeat, to play the watchman ever so thy sake. For thee watch I whilst thou dost wake elsewhere, from me far off, with others all too near. Now here, with Sonnet 61, The poet first wonders if the beloved is deliberately keeping him awake by sending dream images to spy on him, but then admits it is his own devotion and jealousy that will not let him sleep. Lines 1 to 2. We are presented with a rhetorical question, wondering if it is the will or intention of the beloved that their image, possibly a mental or imagined vision, should keep the speaker awake. The phrase heavy eyelids suggests exhaustion, while the phrase weary night sets the tone of some sort of emotional fatigue. And the interplays with these phrases, in a sense, creates an immediate sense of restless yearning. Lines 3 and 4, we are now being the speaker questions whether the beloved intends to disturb his sleep as dreamlike, quote-unquote, shadows resembling the beloved appear to mock him. So these shadows may symbolize unfulfilled desires or memories which haunt him in the night, and the word mock implies pain, as if the visions torment him rather than comfort. Lines 5 and 6. Here the speaker speculates whether the beloved spirit or presence has been sent from afar to spy on him, inspecting his behavior. And so this suggests an intrusive, almost paranoid sense of surveillance, possibly born from the speaker's own guilt or anxiety. Moving on to lines 7 and 8. Here, he imagines the beloved spirit discovering his faults, his shame and idleness, things that could provoke the beloved's jealousy. And so these lines delve into self-doubt and a fear of not living up to the beloved's expectations. With lines 9 to 10, we are presented with the Volta in the lines 9 to 10. And so the speaker corrects himself. It's not the beloved's jealousy or spirit that keeps him awake, but it's his own love that does so. And so this acknowledgement here in these lines shift the blame inward, which moves from suspicion to personal responsibility for his sleeplessness. Lines 11 to 12, now his love makes him a watchman, a guardian keeping vigil while the beloved is away. And so this idea of playing the watchman, in a sense, suggests some sort of devotion, but it can also suggest unease, perhaps fearing betrayal or simply overwhelmed by just separation. The final couplet, here the emotional tension is emphasized and intensified as well, where the speaker stays awake for the beloved who is awake elsewhere, maybe with someone else. And the phrase others all too near hints at jealousy and the fear of infidelity. And there's also a painful contrast between the speaker's emotional closeness and the beloved's physical and emotional distance. This story actually reminds me of a story from the Canterbury Tales regarding infidelity. I forgot what story it was in particular, but I believe it was the first several stories, but I'm not one out of the first several stories of the Canterbury Tales. It was dealing with infidelity and just crazy mockery and just immoral things between a couple, but I can't believe I forgot this. Yeah, I don't remember the story because I just read a whole bunch this couple of days. By the way, I highly recommend the Canterbury Tales to everyone. I just bought the translated version into modern English because I myself cannot read Old English, but I am kind of learning the languages, but I kind of just wanted to get it over with and just read it off the bat, and so I purchased a modern English translated version of the Canterbury Tales, which I am enjoying significantly, and so I suggest and recommend that book to everyone who is interested. But yeah, that was Sonnet 61. We'll move on to Sonnet 62. Sin of self-love possesses all mine eye, and all my soul, and all my every part. And for this sin there is no remedy, it is so grounded inward in my heart. Methinks no face so gracious is as mine, no shape so true, no truth of such account. And for myself mine own worth do define, as I all other in all worth surmount. But when my glass shows me myself indeed, beaded and chopped with tanned antiquity, mine own self-love quite contrast I read, self so self-loving were iniquity. Tis thee myself that for myself I praise, painting my age with beauty of thy days. And so here, the poet accuses himself of supreme vanity and that he thinks so highly of himself. He then admits, after that, that the self he holds in such esteem is not his physical self, but his other self, which is the beloved. Lines 1 to 4, the speaker opens up with a confession, where he is consumed by self-love or vanity. Now, the sin ultimately affects his vision and his soul and his body, and it is totally inescapable. And the phrase no remedy suggests that the love of self is deeply ingrained and part of his very existence, his very being. And so we see that there is a spiritual and almost physical corruption here, which emphasizes the extent of the speaker's narcissism. And so that we are presented with in lines 1 to 4. With lines 5 to 8, the speaker describes the delusion of self-admiration. And so he believes his face is the most gracious, and his body is the most perfect, and his honesty is the most valuable. And we can see that he's the both subject and judge of his own value, arrogantly placing himself above all others. And the use, the phrase surmount, shows not just confidence, but a kind of self-idolization. And so he believes that he surpasses everyone else in every sort of way, physical, mental, moral, everything. Lines 9 to 12. Now, we are presented here with the volta, the turning point, specifically in line 9 with the phrase but, and the mirrored glass, how it reveals the truth. And so he sees his aging face, worn and chopped by time, with tanned antiquity, suggesting that it's the darkened and weathered skin of old age. However, this vision contradicts his internal vanity, though, and he realizes that loving himself, despite this decay, is not just foolish, but unjust, in the phrase iniquity. And we are kind of progressing from a boastful tone to an introspective tone here. The final couplet, we are offered a resolution. And so the speaker realizes that his love isn't truly for himself, but for the phrase thee, for the beloved youth. And so he praises himself only because he sees the youth's beauty reflected in himself. And he tries to mask the ugliness of age by mentally overlaying the beauty of the younger person onto his own declining form. This blurs the boundary, in a sense, between self-love and love of the other, and ultimately suggests that this is an identity through an idealization. Moving on to Sonnet 63. Against my love shall be as I am now, with time's injurious hand crushed and overworn, when hours have drained his blood and filled his brow, with lines and wrinkles when his youthful morn hath travelled on to age's sleepy night, and all those beauties whereof now he's king are vanishing or vanished out of sight, stealing away the treasure of his spring. For such a time do I now fortify against confounding age's cruel knife, that he shall never cut from memory my sweet love's beauty, though my lover's life. His beauty shall in these black lines be seen, and they shall live, and he in them still green. Now here, by preserving the youthful beauty of the beloved in poetry, the poet makes preparation for the day that the beloved will himself become old. Lines 1 to 4. Here, the speaker imagines a future moment when the beloved, like the speaker himself, will be aged and worn down by time. And so the phrase time's injurious hand suggests violence and how time is personified as a destructive force. And the phrase drained his blood is a metaphor for vitality fading, while the phrases lines and wrinkles are literal signs of aging, which also invoke the metaphor of a page or lines, and which foreshadows the poem's medium. Lines 5 to 8, the phrase youthful morn and age's steepy night are metaphors for the life cycle, dawn to night, equating youth to old age. The phrase steepy adds a sense of difficulty or descent, as though aging is not just natural, but also a kind of fall or decline. Now the beloved is the king of his beauty and is destined to lose his reign. And so this suggests both power and physical splendor fleeting. Lines 9 to 12. The phrase treasure of his spring refers to youth and vitality, which are metaphors of spring and how it underscores renewal, beauty, and life. And we could see that the speaker prepares fortify from the phrase fortify, how the speaker prepares against the future loss as though building a defense. And the phrase confounding age's cruel knife continues the metaphor of time as a violent force and is likened to a knife that severs life and beauty. Now, the contrast between physical death in the phrase my lover's life and memory or art in the phrase my sweet love's beauty is significant here, as we are given the notion that beauty can endure beyond life. The final couplet, the black lines are seen as the ink on the page, and so Shakespeare's poetry itself, and the still green means in the sense ever youthful and untouched by time. And so we are presented with, through the final couplet, it affirms the poet's power, the poem's power to preserve the beloved's beauty indefinitely. And we are also presented with the notion that the triumph of art over time will flourish and prosper. Over time and death will triumph. And so that was Sonnet 63. Before we move on to Sonnet 64, I have one more song to play for you guys from Vern Chichu, and the song is called Stranger in My Own Land. So we'll be right back after we take a listen to this one. We'll be right back.
I'm a stranger in my own land. 'Cause I'm a stranger, don't understand. 'Cause I'm a stranger in my own land. I'm just a young boy living in dreams, full of ambition, running like a stream. Then it all came down, thunder, lightning, and rain. I'm not the only one, there's a whole lot of pain. Yeah. Yes, I'm a stranger in my own land. Yes, I'm a stranger. Tension in my mind, it's taking a long time to right the wrongs deep down inside. I want to be alone in the thunder road. And struck down, teardrops like rain wash away my pain. Yes, I'm no stranger, just a human being.
That was Stranger in My Own Land. We'll move on to Sonnet 64. When I have seen my times fell hand-defaced, the rich proud cost of outworn buried age, when sometime lofty towers I see downraged, and brass eternal slave to moral rage, when I have seen the hungry ocean gain advantage on the kingdom of the shore, and the firm soil win of the watery main, increasing store with loss and loss with store. When I have seen such interchange of state, or state itself confounded due decay, ruin hath taught me to thus to ruminate, that time will come and take my love away. This thought is as death, which cannot choose, but weep to have that which it fears to lose. This is a sign of the destructive power of time and decay, and a force that the poet will admit that the beloved will almost or always be lost to him and to mourn this anticipated loss. The first quatrain kind of focuses on the destructive power of time. And so the phrase, time's fell hand, personifies time as a malevolent force capable of disfiguring and erasing. And the phrase defaced suggests a violent alteration of the past, while the phrase the rich, proud cost of outworn buried age evokes the idea of things that were once grand and significant but are now forgotten or buried, victims of time's inevitability. The second quatrain, we're presented with a metaphor of the sea encroaching upon land to highlight the cyclical nature of destruction and renewal, and also a paradox of the increasing store with loss and love, loss and loss with store, and how that reflects the cyclical dual nature of time's effects, and how gain is often accompanied by loss, and destruction makes room for new creation. The third quatrain kind of moves from examples of nature and civilization to the more personal idea of love. And the speaker claims that the observations of decay and change have led them to a somber conclusion that time will eventually take away their love. And through the final couplet, it kind of encapsulates the emotional impact of this realization. The thought of time taking away the speaker's love is compared to death itself, not in a literal sense, but as something so profoundly painful that it brings grief. And the use of cannot choose suggests that this thought is unavoidable, and that the speaker feels helpless in the face of its inevitability. And so here the paradox is that while the speaker fears losing their love, the very awareness of that loss brings a type of mourning before it happens. And this ultimately illustrates how our fear of time's passage can shape our experience of it. Moving on to Sonnet 65. Since brass, nor stone, nor earth, nor boundless sea, but sad mortality overweighs their power, how with this rage shall beauty hold a plea, whose action is no stronger than a flower? Oh, how shall summer's honey breathe hold out against the wrackful siege of battering days, when rocks impregnable are not so stout, nor gates of steel so strong, but time decays? Oh, fearful mediation, meditation where, alack, shall time's best jewel from time's chest lie hid? Or what strong hand can hold his swift foot back, or who his spoil of beauty can forbid? Oh, none unless this miracle have might, that in black ink my love may still shine bright. So here in the face of the terrible power of time, the poet asks, can beauty survive? And so the only protection of injury, he decides, lies in the lines of his poetry. And so lines 1 to 4, the speaker begins by listing powerful, enduring elements like brass, stone, earth, and the sea, each symbolizing permanence and strength. However, these are all ultimately subject to mortality. And the irony here is that even the most formidable forces cannot escape time's destructive influence. And so we're presented here with a central tension of the poem, where fragility of beauty, which is described as weaker than a flower, and the image of a flower, delicate and short-lived, reinforces the idea that beauty, like nature, is fleeting. And the question, how with this rage shall beauty hold a plea, is significant, where it expresses the speaker's doubt that beauty can endure in the face of such overwhelming destruction. Lines 5-8. Now here the speaker laments that even the honey breath of summer, which is a metaphor for the sweetness and vitality of life and beauty, cannot withstand the ravages of time. And now the use of decays here implies that no matter how strong something may appear, it will eventually break down. And this line builds the sense of time's all-encompassing power and the inevitability of decay. Lines 9 to 12. Here in these lines, the speaker is overwhelmed by the thought of time's destructive power. And the phrase fearful meditation indicates that the contemplation of time's ability to destroy beauty is both troubling and inescapable. Now, the speaker poses some rhetorical questions about whether there is any way to protect beauty from time's swift march, in the phrase swift foot, or whether anyone can prevent the inevitable spoiling of beauty. And the use of spoil here refers to time's destructive power, like a conqueror seizing a sort of treasure. The final couplet, we are offered a solution again through almost what seems like a miracle. And so the miracle is the power of writing, emphasized in black ink, where the speaker believes that though through the written word, love and beauty can endure. And so the phrase, my love may still shine bright, suggests that the act of writing through its permanence on paper can preserve love and beauty against time's inevitable decay. And the imagery of black ink, again, also contrasts with the natural world of decay, presenting writing as a medium that can resist the ravages of time. And so that was the final couplet. The conclusion is also an affirmation of the immortality that poetry can grant to beauty and love. Moving on to Sonnet 66. Tired with all these, for restful death I cry, as to behold desert a beggar born, and needy nothing trimmed in jollity, and purest faith unhappily forsworn, and gilded honor shamefully misplaced, and maiden virtue rudely strumpeted, and right perfection wrongfully disgraced, and strength by limping away disabled, and art made tongue tied by authority, and folly doctor-like controlling skill, and simple truth miscalled simplicity, and captive good attending captain ill, tired with all these, from these would I be gone, save that to die I leave my love alone. Now here the poet lists some examples of the societal wrongs that have made him so wary of life that he would wish to die, except that he would thereby desert the beloved. The phrase tired with all these, we'll kind of go through the significant phrases here, but tired with all these, for restful death I cry. It's an opening expression of exhaustion, and the speaker is overwhelmed by the injustices and corruptions they see in the world. And the restful death here doesn't mean seeking death in a suicidal sense, but rather wishing for an escape from the turmoil, to find peace and release from the suffering. The phrase asked to behold desert a beggar born, now here the irony of desert and birth is significant, and how these lines point to the injustice of virtue in the phrase desert being associated with someone born into poverty. And this implies that deserving qualities do not match the station one is born into, which ultimately highlights societal and social injustice. The phrase, and needy, nothing trimmed in jollity, is a contradiction of need and false joy. And this suggests that those who have nothing are dressed up in a superficial happiness, and points to the disparity between true needs and empty appearances in society. The phrase purest faith unhappily forsworn, we are presented with some loss of innocence and betrayal. And so here, faith is described as pure, but betrayed, which is very interesting. And this could refer to personal or societal disillusionment, where what was once holy or innocent, as in faith, is now broken or forsaken. The phrase "guilt and gilded honor shamefully misplaced" is also significant, because the image of gilded honor refers to something precious but outwardly glorified, yet misplaced, and is a symbol of how true honor is often wrongly awarded or abused in society. And the phrase "maiden virtue rudely strumpeted" is a corruption of virtue, and how the maiden virtue refers to the purity or goodness of youth, and strumpeted, which means prostituted or corrupted, suggests that this virtue is violated and defiled for the world. The phrase "and folly doctor-like controlling skill," now here the doctor metaphor suggests that those who are foolish or ignorant have taken the place of those who should have wisdom and expertise. And so we can see that this is a critique of misplaced authority. The phrase "and single truth miscalled simplicity" can be seen as the misinterpretation of truth. And so truth, which should be clear and simple, is here misinterpreted or undervalued as just mere simplicity. And so this could reflect how complex truths are often dismissed or misunderstood in society. The phrase "and captive good intending captain ill," the good here is held captive by the ill, the corrupt or wrong. And this symbolizes how virtue is often under the command of vice, which highlights the inversion of values in society. The phrase "tired with all these, from these would I be gone," is a desire to escape, and the speaker repeats the longing to be free of these societal contradictions, injustices, and corruptions, and the desire for escape intensifies after listing all of these wrongs. Here the quote "save that to die I leave my love alone," which comes at the very end, is we could see this as a pull of love. And so the speaker's final hesitation in seeking death is rooted in love. While disillusioned by the world, the speaker does not wish to leave their loved one behind, which ultimately reveals the conflict between the desire for escape and the responsibility of love. And so that was Sonnet 66, and we have come to the end of our episode already. And so, that was pretty intense. We did a lot of close reading and analysis, but had lots of fun, at least for me. I hope you guys did too. I have another episode tomorrow at 11 a.m., and so if you guys are interested, please come tune in. We'll be starting off Sonnet 67. Other than that, if you guys have anything else for me to go over, more poetry, or anything else related to literature and music, I'll be more than happy to go over it for you guys. But that is the end of today's episode. I hope you guys have a wonderful rest of your day, and I will see you guys again tomorrow at 11. Thank you all. Bye-bye.